Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. It was Robert Frost who wrote memorably of the path not taken. His reference was to the unchosen possibilities of a man's life, to what might have been. Nations face choices, too. In the late 1930s, the chief democracies of Western Europe chose not to forge a military alliance with the Soviet Union against the resolute threat of rising German power. And the war came. To say that a Soviet-British-French alliance would have deterred the implacable advance of the Nazis is to claim too much. But there can be little doubt that such a powerful compact would have given the fascists an enormous challenge and altered the course of history. My guest is Michael Jabara Carley, author of 1939. Michael, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let me say at the outset, is a very important book, and it's the story of what would seem to be a very obvious alliance that, quite frankly, and obviously never took place. And it's also, to me, Michael Carley, an example of human character as much as it is of great implacable forces. And I guess that's my first question to you. Did you, in fact, as you wrote this, see it that way, that it's not just the political and economic forces of the time, but also the guidance of men, and often seriously flawed men, who to me seemed at times more loyal to class and ideology than anything else?
Yes, I would say that's true. And I think it's one of the tragedies of the 20th century that a small group of men in France, in Britain, in the Soviet Union, in Poland, Romania, maybe 100 men and not women, held the fate of the entire world in their hands. And the decisions they took were the wrong decisions and led to the Second World War that we and all the destruction and all the death of tens of millions of people that we know about now.
I think that's precisely right and well said. And you know, I may say that that's one of the revelations of this book, because it brings forth a very, very full portrait, if you will, of the types of men that we're talking about here and their character. And it also suggested something else to me, Michael, and this is one reader's perception, as I read this with absolute fascination, that perhaps a leader's most valuable quality is not the one that we so often see, quote, the visionary sense of the future, the futuristic sense of what's happening tomorrow, but rather a sense, an ability to precisely understand the moment they're living in, to understand where clear and present danger is and distinguishing between threats. And I sort of took it that few of these men were able to do that.
That's true. And I would add one other thing, that really great men are able to think beyond themselves, beyond their class, beyond their circumstances, and to recognize what is absolutely crucial to the interests and fate of their nations. And there were a few men like that in the 1930s, but they didn't control the direct levers of power, and their influence, as great as it was at times, was not enough to change the direction of what is now history.
You know, we're going to go into some of those personalities in depth in our conversation, because they're brought out, both the heroes and the villains of the story. But in essence, Michael Carley, would you agree that this is the story, basically, of why the Soviets ended up signing a non-aggression pact with Adolf Hitler, and that your principal argument, and do correct me if I'm wrong on it, is simply that British and French statesmen in particular simply couldn't bring themselves to countenance a pact with the Soviets against the Nazis?
That's right. It's true. And the reason, the fundamental reason that they couldn't bring themselves to do it, and this will probably sound shocking to many of your readers, is that they feared winning, defeating Nazi Germany on the side of the Soviet Union, because winning by their lights, by the lights of the conservative French and British elites who were making these decisions, victory meant the spread of of Soviet influence and prestige into the middle of Europe and perhaps even the spread of communism into the middle of Europe.
So essentially that they feared communism more than they feared Nazism.
Just so. And that was the fundamental question, not only of the 1930s, but of the 1920s as well. Who was enemy number one? Who was the paramount enemy of France and Britain, Germany or Soviet Russia? And most of the folks that were governing France and Britain during those years got the answer wrong.
You know, it's interesting why they got the answer wrong. And here's another of the things that I discovered in reading the book. I, quite frankly, hadn't even really known this, that the 1920s, I mean, we think of the Cold War of the 50s and the late 40s and the 60s as being, you know, a sort of very rife contest between the West and Soviet Union. But there was really kind of a Cold War attitude in the 20s, wasn't there? I mean, sort of an intense dislike and fear of Bolshevism in particular in the West. Is that right?
That's right. And it's not a kind of Cold War. It was Cold War. Mm. And I have often called it in my written work the early Cold War. Most folks, when you think about the Cold War, they think about the struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union after 1945. But that was only the later Cold War. The early Cold War began with the Bolshevik Revolution in November of 1917 and continued right up until 1940 with the collapse of France.
Let me ask you now about two mysteries that I'd love to have you. Actually, the book clarifies a lot of this, but I think it'd be interesting to talk about them now. First is this. Michael Carley, why did the French yield so readily to British influence and so consistently? I mean, it seemed to me the driving force of Western diplomacy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union throughout this was largely set in London, and that the French almost always seemed to go along or at least play a secondary role in overtures and responses to Russia.
French society was horribly divided in the 1930s between right and left, between socialists and communists, and between the center and far right mainly in Paris. One of the famous slogans of the 1930s in France was rather Hitler than Blum. Léon Blum was the socialist premier of France who was elected in 1936. The center-right preferred Hitler to their own socialist premier. They were petrified of socialism. They were afraid of losing their privileges and their flats and their property and their privileged position in society. And they couldn't combine with the left to face the growing danger of Nazi Germany. They were too divided. They were too uncertain about themselves. They're coming out of the world. The First World War had shattered their confidence in themselves, right, to some degree. They had suffered terrible casualties during the war, mm-hmm, the First World War. They just could not recover their confidence in themselves.
But you know, it's interesting. I mean, again, as read as a kind of a moral fable, you know, one tends to think time and time again in this account that the quote, it's an old adage, there are none so blind as those who will not see. Yeah. And it just seems that both in terms of classes of people and the leaders of those classes, that the power of their connection to their ideologies and their bigotries kept them from seeing larger things time after time. Speaking of that, let me reverse this now, Michael Carley, and just ask you a what-if question, a kind of devil's advocate question. Because in point of fact, as you as an historian well know, one of the chief calls of Soviet communism, of communism as an ideology, was, quote, for world revolution. So I guess this is a two-part question. Why, just as a strategic move, didn't the Russians ever choose to moderate that, since that was such an obvious hurdle for the Western powers to overcome? And if they had done so, do you think that would have made much of a difference?
Well, I would say that the following, that the bulk of the new evidence coming out of Soviet archives does not show an early Soviet Union, an early Soviet government seeking revolution, world revolution. It shows a careful, pragmatic, conservative foreign policy led by skilled diplomats and clever businessmen. Whoever would have thought that Bolsheviks would have made good businessmen? But it's true, they did. And Stalin, this person who was in fact in many ways so evil, wasn't really – the evidence that we have suggests that he was a cold-blooded pragmatist who didn't care a pin about revolution outside of the Soviet Union. And many of the diplomats in the West, in the United States, in France, and Britain, recognized this pragmatism, saw evidence of it, but the ideologues of the West weren't prepared to believe it and to respond to it. There were several instances, for example, in the 1920s when and the most important one, I think, was in France in 1926-1927. The Soviet Union offered very important concessions to the French government in order to come to a political and economic settlement with the Soviet Union, with France, and the French refused it, declined it flat out.
Because of?
Because there were elections coming. There were elections coming in France in 1928, and the elections were between right and left, and the Red Scare, the Red Bogey that we think about so much after 1940 was just as important, just as hot, just as powerful in the 1920s as it was in the United States after 1945. And the right wanted to win elections in France, and they couldn't do it by making a deal, by making an important agreement with the Soviet Union.
This is fascinating stuff. Let me take a moment from our conversation, Michael Carley, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest is Michael Jabara Carley, author of 1939, published by Ivan R. D. Press. Michael Carley, as I promised earlier, I want to focus on some of the people who did get the thing right and whose voices, although they were in the wilderness for some time, ultimately prevailed because they were making the right points. Winston Churchill is the best-known example of someone who saw the logic of a tripartite alliance, even, as you point out, one had to hold one's nose. And there were others, people like Robert Vanastart and others whose names are not so well known to the public. But for all of these men in Britain and in France, what accounts for their particular foresight? Why were they able to essentially howl into the wind or stand against the tide the way they did?
It's a very good question, and I really can't give you a ready answer. There were many different individuals, and the reasons that each of them had were unique to themselves. The only thing I can say is that they did recognize the danger and that they should be honored now for having recognized that danger. I mean, we honor our soldiers who fought against Nazism in the Second World War. But I think, and some of my colleagues disagree with me about this, I think it's very important to honor the men and the women before 1939 who saw this danger coming, who tried to alert their governments and their people, and who didn't succeed but never gave up.
I completely agree with you, and I'll say that with full force, because it seems to me that that's just the kind of person, the kind of man and woman we'll always need. So it makes every sense to recognize those who did that then in the hope that we can have others do it for us again, and we'll certainly be needing them. Let me recommend to you my candidate for the most intriguing of these figures. It was the Russian commissar, Maxim Litvinov, if I cannot pronounce it correctly, who in many ways I thought it was kind of ultimately a tragic figure, but he was among the first to call for collective security against Hitler. And I'd love to get your opinion of this man, because I found him an intriguing, truly intriguing and perhaps somewhat frustrated character in all of this.
I've been accused of openly admiring Maxim Maximovich Litvinov. And it's true, I do. And I hope that the next book that I'm going to write is going to be a biography of Litvinov, if only the archivists in Moscow will cooperate with me and let me see the paper, his papers, which I need to produce this book. He began as a gun runner. He is an old Bolshevik. He began as a gun runner, a money launderer. He produced illegal newspapers. He was arrested by the Tsar's cops and put in jail. He managed to escape. And then in 1917, he'd spent 10 years in Britain. He married a British woman. He had children. He loved his children. In 1917, when the revolution, Bolshevik revolution, broke out in Russia, he happened to be in London, and he became one of the Soviet Russia's first representatives abroad. And from the very beginning, you can see his pragmatism in dealing with the West, in trying to find solutions to problems, in trying to improve political relations, at least making them businesslike, in trying to improve trade relations, which were vitally important to the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s, and in trying simply to assure the security of his country. He's an extraordinary individual.
I do hope you write a book about him, because he was one of my discoveries. As I'm no expert on the period, but I'd never heard of him. And I think the things he did and the way he did them really merit much greater attention. Of course, Neville Chamberlain is famous for leading the other camp, and the camp that was, in the first instance, victorious and preventing an alliance. He also is kind of a tragic character, largely because of the way history has been compelled to judge him. And my shorthand for him was that he had certainly the courage of his convictions, but unfortunately they were the wrong ones. But in pursuing appeasement with the sort of steadfast energy he did, was he kind of, let me put it this way, did appeasement as a strategy have a different connotation in that period? I mean, it seems to me, why did they look upon appeasement as not dishonorable?
Exactly so. Neville Chamberlain and Halifax and many of their colleagues wanted to see Nazi Germany as not such a bad thing. They wanted to bring Germany into the European fold, so to speak. They wanted cooperation. They wanted to avoid war by virtually any means. And to them, it was a good thing to try and avoid war. And indeed, it is. The wisdom comes in recognizing that you can't, and that you have to.
Absolutely.
You have to take measures to provide for the security and defense of your country, and that's where they just didn't have it. They kept, in all the documents that I've read, they often refer to Herr Hitler, Mr. Hitler, with this sign of respect and the fond hope that finally he would just come around. And of course, he never did.
You know, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the things that I found absolutely amazing and as a result of reading 1939 is that kind of thinking, if you can call it that, by these men led to me, the most amazing strategic misstep in the entire story. Britain's guarantee to Poland, to defend Poland, without a pact with the Russians that would have involved the Russians in helping check the Germans. In other words, the guarantee was extended to Poland at a time when Britain and France would not enter into this alliance with Russia. Therefore, I mean, they created probably the worst military strategic setting I could imagine for what inevitably happened next.
There's no other way to describe that situation than incomprehensible. The wiser minds of the British government recognized early on in the spring of 1939 that they absolutely had to have an alliance with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Churchill, David Lloyd George, the former Liberal Prime Minister, got up repeatedly in the House of Commons and said, come on, guys, let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. We've got to have this alliance. It's crucial. There can't be an Eastern Front against Nazi Germany without the Soviet Union. And I'd have to say that Chamberlain almost single-handedly sabotaged and stopped the movement by Britain towards an alliance with the Soviet Union. He bears a tremendous responsibility for the failure of negotiations in 1939 to achieve a war-fighting alliance against Nazi Germany.
But I guess the real question is, did Stalin, as a result of all this dithering and indecision on the part of the Western powers, feel that, in your opinion, he had no option but to make this pact with the Germans to protect his own country?
Many people have said that, and I sometimes lean in that direction. But one of the things I try to point out in my book is that he did have options. Some of his diplomats in Paris and London said that in spite of all the double dealing on the part of the French and the British, in spite of all their foot dragging, that they ought to engage the French and the British, and they ought to accept as a basis of negotiation the half-hearted, bad faith even, proposals that the French and the British put forward. Mm-hmm. So Stalin had options in the summer of 1939, really difficult options, because he was afraid of being left in the lurch by the French and the British, who in fact left Poland in the lurch in September. He was afraid of having to fight Nazi Germany by himself. His country faced the greatest dangers, but he did have options, and he chose wrong. Mm-hmm. It's understandable that he chose wrong, but this is hindsight. This mm-hmm. is easy hindsight. But in hindsight, he did choose wrongly. But we can see that he did have options at mm-hmm. the time.
Well, I never want to be accused of being an apologist for a monster like Joseph Stalin. But the view from Moscow in 1938 and 39, did include these kind of factors, because as the book points out, France, for example, had signed this arms pact, military assistance pact, with Russia in about 1935, but effectively never implemented it, never went to staff talks, despite repeated Russian requests for implementation of the agreement. And then Britain had done things, as I understood them, like ask the Russians to defend Lithuania and other places it was the most – arrogance is a word that quite frankly occurs to one, because there was no twinned promise to help defend Russia. So yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. He had options. But one can also see how he saw little chance of making these things work, perhaps, in terms of a Western alliance.
His choices were terrible, and – he had no reason whatsoever to trust the British and the French, and that's the sad thing. The British and the French, the first thing they did after the Bolshevik Revolution was try to overthrow the Soviet government. They sent military forces. They blockaded. They put an airtight blockade around Soviet Russia. They tried to starve it to death. And then in the 1920s, on several occasions, the Soviet government offered concessions to the French and the British and the Americans too, by the way, which they all rejected. Mm-hmm. In the 1930s, security became the most important question for all the countries concerned. Once again, the Soviet offered what Litvinov called collective security. They signed an agreement with the French in 1935, and for 3 years, the Soviets practically begged the French to conduct military staff talks, mm-hmm. and the French weren't interested.
Yeah.
It's a terrible, terrible story. And the choices that Stalin faced in 19, 39 were a kind of a Sophie's choice. You know, you give away your daughter, you sacrifice your daughter, or you sacrifice your son. It's terrible.
It is a terrible story, but it's an extremely important one to be read now, all these years later. And having read it, I want to ask you this, Michael Carley, as a concluding question of our conversation. It's I suppose the question is almost an obvious one, and that's, what's the moral of this tale? And without wanting to answer my own question, let me just share with you what one reader, that is me, took from it. And for me, it's a story about ultimately the nature of leadership, that humanity is always going to need leaders who can first correctly perceive the threat, secondly challenge orthodoxy in their response to it, and then most importantly accept the personal risk of unpopular stands. But that's one man's reaction to your book, and I'd rather hear yours as the author's.
I think that people have to be able to rise above themselves. They have to be able to look beyond their immediate interests, the money in their pocket, the number of shares of stock they hold, and they have to have the wisdom to recognize, in terms of the security of their country, what's most important. And they have to be able to, as you said, stand up and be unafraid of challenging and facing and resisting what the majority want to do. They have to be able to stand and face the storm alone if necessary.
Michael, that rises to the level of eloquence. And as I said at the outset, this is a very important book. I join you in your hope that humankind will begin to recognize and honor these people, because we will always need them. The book is 1939 by Michael Jabara Carley, published by Ivan R.D. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
So did I. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was Michael Jabara Carley. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And production assistants are Kirsten LaCour-Dabelko and Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.